Okay, it's actually two quite different talks that I have to give. And the first one is not related to physics at all. It's about Adelette, who was my actually climbing partner for quite a few years. And we went to a few expeditions with him. And I would like to say a few words about that. And before talking about physics, which is completely different story. So, well, that is a photo that you can see also at the entrance to the hall. And this photo actually was taken in one of our expeditions together. I think that was in 2008. And you see here a quote from my friend, professional climber Sokolov, that actually had many achievements. And I think that this quote describes Adelette quite well. He was indeed extremely patient and extremely stubborn when in all this. And that was, of course, a double-edged sword. It worked very well in both climbing and physics, but it also led to the fatal accident. So I would like first to show you where all these expeditions took place, because if I just mention these places, they probably say nothing to you. So here is Almaty, where Adelette was born, and here is the Great Desert in northwest China. This is Masherbrum. This is the border of China and Pakistan. So this is Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan. And, well, this is Afghanistan and Afghan corridor, which separates Russia, which separated Russia and Great Britain back 150 years ago. And no, it's not a joke. And these are the main mountains that we went to together. And this is a little expedition that we undertook when our small children were born and we couldn't go to a serious undertaking. That's Mustaq Ata that I think was mentioned before. So the expedition of 2007 was to this Masherbrum Mountain, which is also known actually as K1, because it is the first big mountain that was discovered by British survey expedition again back in 19th century. And of course, we know, as you know now, K2 is higher, but that was discovered later. So that's a mountain a little bit below 8,000, and the way goes somewhat like that. And all these expeditions, all these two serious expeditions that we went to, they are the places which are rarely, or actually even never, visited by anybody. So this Masherbrum was first climbed in 62, I think. And for the last 20 or 30 years, I now lost the count, there was not a single successful expedition to it. So not a single person even reached this upper plateau where we have been with Adelette. And actually the reason why, well, part of the reason why we didn't reach the mountain is a bit funny, because Adelette had to get married. And in a truly Kazakh, in his traditional way, he invited about 200 or 300 people to his wedding ceremony in Almaty. And it turned out that he didn't plan the dates very well. So when he were sitting somewhere here at 6,000 and counting, whether he has still, you know, a day or two in order to reach his wedding in time, or he has to run down. And eventually he decided that 200 or 300 angry people is not a good thing to risk, and he has to run down. But it was really a very difficult decision to him to go down. Extremely difficult. Okay, so that was one expedition. And another expedition was more recent. It is to this Khanjut Sar that I showed you before. This is even, well, the Khanjur Tsar itself was climbed from the south on this, by this ridge. It was also in early 60s. But we were the first people who tried, well, actually not even tried, who got to this plateau here. Well, you see that on Google you cannot, we can hardly see anything, and that's not surprising. There are, and there is no even maps of this region because, as I said, nobody was ever there before us or after. So we reached this point very close to the peak, well, because it's the route turned out to be very difficult. This year, we were there again, and when we learned about this tragic news, we tried, we changed our plan, and we tried, well, we almost practically reached the top of this little peak here, which we try, well, it's not very little, it's actually 7,000. And we tried to do that because we wanted to name it after Adelaide, and I hope that next year we'll succeed. Because, well, the weather this year was incomparably, well, terribly bad. So, okay, so let me go now. Let me now just show a few, slides from the, from our expeditions, just because I want, at least for myself, I certainly want to remember Adelaide as he was there. He was, as I said, one of the best partners in this non-trivial undertaking, and that's a lot. So that is the mountain that we attempted back in 2007, this Mushroom, and it is here on the top of this, I think it's called Snow Peak, 6,100 meters, that we were sitting with Adelaide and thinking whether he will make it to his wedding or not. Yes, so there are just, so there's just a few slides that I want quickly to show because it's not, that's on the first ice fall. Does it work or not? Oh, yeah, just a second. Yeah. So I'll just quickly go through them because I understand that this is, that is the plateau that was mentioned before, where we were sitting. And this is now this expedition, that's very simple, Mustaqata Mountain. You see that it's completely different story that we went to when our children were born. And that's how he typically looked like in the tent. Yeah, as you see, the way here is pretty easy, just to walk up. That is also very typical of him. Well, actually, he would prefer meat, of course. And finally, yes, here he would sit for a long time in the base camp tent, and actually in the down jacket because it's not so warm, and looking at his at some papers or at his laptop, and waiting for the weather. And finally, well, at the very top. He was actually very, also very proud to be a Kazakh, so he usually carried Kazakh flag with him. So, and this is this Khanjur Tsar, and here is our route, well, which to, on which we got basically to this point on this ridge. Yeah. And this is actually our team with people of different, very different backgrounds, and actually even professional climbers, some of the professional climbers. I shall say that he was, I would say, almost as good as this, as the professional climber. This is Afanasyev here, to whom he is standing next, almost as strong and as good technically. Okay. So that's, oop, why? I wonder what's wrong with it. Just a second. Nah, sorry. Don't know what's wrong with it. Wait. Yes, that's from the same trip, last trip that we take with him, that we took with him. And yeah, that's, and this is my basically last slide, on which that is a picture of the mountain that I would like to name after him if I manage to get to the top. And that's actually where we got to and the reason why we turned back. Yes, that's actually even better. So, right. Yes, that's again Mashable. Okay, so that's it. Okay, on this note, I would like to finish this very sad part and turn to physics, which is much easier to talk about. All right. So, so I would like to talk about the thing that I do not understand, and as far as I know, nobody understands, which is the very strange phase, which is in contradiction to what one reasonable, a sensible person would expect theoretically. So, the talk will have two parts, really. One is that I will, well, of course, there will be some introduction and general blah, 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 that about Josephson junction arrays. Then I will show you experimental data from, mostly from, recent data from Gershonson group at Rutgers, not because this thing was completely unknown before. It was unknown, but basically pushed under the carpet, and what Misha Gershonson and his collaborators at Rutgers have shown that this is not just an experimental artifact, but really a serious problem. Then I will say a few, I've mumbled a few words about the possible reason for this strange thing, which it's really mumbling. And then I will show you that the numerical solution, which is numerical data available to us, show that something very similar indeed happens in theoretical models. And again, mumble a few words about glassiness that is responsible for that. So that's basically the plan. As I said, there is no real theory and no real understanding. I would like just to emphasize in this talk that there is a serious problem which needs to be addressed. So the beginning is that, well, just because all previous talks were on completely different subjects, let me remind you what is a Josephson junction array. So we have the pieces of superconductor, which are characterized by superconducting phases, and connected by Josephson junctions, and each plaquette in this lattice might be frustrated by the flux. So if in the ideal lattice, which is actually, as I will argue, is never realized anywhere, the Hamiltonian, which describes this the system, contains the Josephson energy, which is just a cosine of the phase difference, and the charging energy of the of these islands and junctions. So the charges interact with inverse capacitance matrix, and the capacitance matrix can be in two different varieties. One variety is, well, it always contains the term which is due to the capacitance of the junctions, and which term can be viewed as the discrete Laplace operator, and it might contain the diagonal part. Well, the diagonal part might be dominant, and in this case, this interaction is purely local, because of course, if this term is dominant, it's purely diagonal, and therefore inverse is also diagonal, and you have just charging energy of the individual charge of the individual ions. However, if the capacitance is dominated by the junctions, then the inverse Laplace operator, of course, is quite singular in two dimensions, and of course, low lattices are two dimensional. So the system is has a long range interaction between the charges. So especially if, in this case, when you have a purely diagonal dominated capacitance, well, you have simply Q squared. And well, if you look at this Hamiltonian, it's quite clear what happens without doing any calculation. It's clear there are two phases. In one phase, there is a long range order in the phase. In another phase, you have this term dominates. So you have ground state, which corresponds to all charges which are zero. And you have expect the transition, and this is insulating phase with a gap, because the lowest excitation is charge one, which costs energy, and therefore you come up with this picture that you have ordered superconductor, and then you have the phase in which you have a gap to all charged excitations. When the gap goes to zero, you get superconductivity. Very good. So now data. The data for a long time, well, it was known that this simple transition in which you have either a superconductor or thermally activated behavior with a gap is not, in fact, realized in nature. So here are some data from Gershenson group. As I said, that similar data was observed before by Perdelsing, 15 years ago, and by Mui, and by Van der Zandt. So you see what happens here is that instead of the there is some intermediate regime in which resistance changes by orders and orders of magnitude, but remains constant in temperature. And that should be contrasted to the similar behavior in the films, where you also can induce the transition between, study the transition between superconductor and insulator, where you see very good critical point, just one point, so resistance either grows with temperature or goes down with temperature. There is a clear transition between just superconductor and insulator. Here there is something strange in the middle. So, If you can fit these curves which grow to the activating behavior, and you can ask yourself, what is the activation gap? And you see that here the activation gap goes down to zero. That's natural. However, I should go a little bit up. However, let me talk about this picture first. However, when the activation energy goes down to zero, you do not see the appearance of the superconductivity, which will show as the activation behavior as the exponential decrease in conductivity. Instead, you see a large regime where it's just nothing. That is, T naught is just zero. It's not always like that. That is depending on the arrays and magnetic fields and many other details. You could see the transition as you would expect. That is, the resistivity either goes up or down. However, very often you see this strange intermediate phase between the superconductor and insulator. So in this intermediate regime, let me go back to this picture, You also see very strange current voltage characteristics, in which are completely featureless. That is, you would expect. Yeah, sorry. Well, yes. Well, not large. In order, you should be have a weak sub in order to observe this strange regime empirically. What you need to start with is a weak superconductor. So you have to choose EGA over AC so that it's superconducting, but you do not need large field to make it insulator.
So the zero flux is
superconductor. Right. But a poor superconductor, not the one which forms at very high temperature, it's a poor superconductor. If you start with a very good superconductor and then drive it insulating by very large field, you have this type of behavior. Empirically, I have absolutely no explanation why there are such correlations. Okay, so the point that I wanted to make is that in this regime, not only you do not see any activation, you do not see any features on current voltage characteristics. So the material is really, roughly speaking, like a metal. Because in metal, the current voltage characteristic is roughly linear. And here also, up to quite high currents, it remains linear. So, and that should be contrasted with what happens when you go a little bit into the insulating or superconducting phase. You start to see features at the current voltage characteristic like that, which show you, well, for instance, these offsets can be viewed as a gap, as a measurement of the gap, because it's voltage on this axis, as a measurement of the intrinsic gap in this arrays. And no such gap is seen in the intermediate phase. So furthermore, you can ask yourself, okay, so suppose I'm in the insulating phase, and that's another, it's actually a separate fact, but perhaps related to this strange behavior. You can say, suppose I'm in the insulating phase, and then I can measure this current voltage characteristic and interpret this offset as a gap, which is very natural because, as probably many of you know, in a Josephson chain, in just one-dimensional chain, that you can show that this offset is exactly the gap in this for the excitations in this chain. And you can ask, suppose I now compare this gap with my T0, with my activation energy that I extracted from the current, from the resistivity versus temperature. To your surprise, they are equal, which means that even a large array is basically dominated by one weak link. However, that adds to another puzzle. That is, on the other hand, if you just take a big array and measure two halves, you will think that if array is dominated by weak link, it's either here or there. So then you should see quite different resistances in the left and right hand parts, and that's not. You see basically this quite normal additive resistance. So. No, you just, you put two, three contacts because you can do whatever you want with this array, right? Hundreds. 100 by 100. Well, you can make it 200 if you really push hard. Where we were. How could one can reconcile, at least in principle, that? Well, the serious and very important ingredient that was missing in what I told you before, theoretically, are the random charges which presumably sit in the barriers between two metals. And these random offset charges change the Hamiltonian describe the arrays. They introduce these offsets, which are as shown here, And also, of course, there are other sources of disorder, because nothing is perfect in this world. There is a disorder in Josephson energies. There's a disorder in flux. However, all these sources of disorder were extensively studied in recently, and it was shown that typically the variation of the flux and the variation of the Josephson energy, at least with time, is minuscule compared to these offset charges. Offset charges really are terribly bad. That is, here are some data for very small contacts, ultra-small contacts by Zimmermann et Nist, which show that how that these charges actually, not only they are completely random, but also they change with time. Also, how fast they change with time really depends on the experimental group. And actually, it depends on many things. Zimmermann told me that it's folklore, of course, because what I heard is that he, in order to see this more or less static behavior, he waited for 3 years. That is, he had to keep his sample cool for 3 years in order to make these charges quiet. So here was the data by Yuropashkin at NSC, which just, you know, which they cooled the sample without waiting much and just observed the drift. And this is drift, yes. This is aluminum. Everything is done from aluminum. Ah, nobody knows how to make contacts out of anything else. Yes. No. Well, we can discuss you know very well that there are some people who try to do other contacts with a smaller number of TLS, and that's a big activity. But success is very far. So what I wanted to say that, in fact, when you make larger arrays, there is a claim by Yale group, by Manachurian, sorry, I misspelled his name, that actually the times are of the order of milliseconds. Wait, if you believe that claim, and for their arrays, it was certainly like that, then it offers you some explanation of this very strange conclusions that on one hand, you see the experimental evidence for the weak link. On the other hand, you do not see that weak link is located either on the left or on the right in your sample. You should say that, look, we have these random charges, and depending on their position at a given time, the weak link is on the left or on the right. But since all these measurements that one can do, at least in Gershon's experiments, take seconds, over these milliseconds, charges move, and we actually average over the weak links which drift around. So theoretically, if you believe this explanation, then theoretically what you really have to solve is this model, which I wrote you before, which I wrote for you before, with Q, which are pseudostatic at the time of the characteristic time at which phases change. Because characteristic time of the phases are due to the charging energies, and these times are of the order of less than nanoseconds, gigahertz. Whereas measurement takes place at second, well, much longer time, and during each measurement point, you effectively average over the charge distribution. So at least then you do not have logical contradiction between the existence and non-existence of the weak link. So the theoretical problem is what we expect for the properties of this model. Do we expect the appearance of this intermediate phase or not? I will now show you some numerical evidence that indeed we expect something weird happens in between. It might be, of course, due to small system sizes, because we do not understand what happens, and we can only work with finite, well, with actually very small system sizes numerically, but still there is some, I would say, very tempting evidence that indeed there is a strange phase forming in between these two states, these two phases. So in order to show you that, I first have to explain how it was done. That is, we take random graphs, and we actually study different, we diagonalize the Hamiltonians, which correspond to the lattice, which correspond to these random graphs, and different Hamiltonians, and which contain the Poorman analog of Josephson coupling, which is just the charge which moves from one position to another, and the random energy. And the random energy. What we see is the transition between two states. In one state, there is Poissonian distribution of levels. Another state is Wigner-Dyson, and we interpret this transition as the point at which the states, many body states become coherent, and then it tells us where the transition from this real insulator to the state where the excitation scan decay happens. Yes. I look for this quantity average R, which is the level statistic, which determines you the level statistics. So you really ask where the level statistics is Poissonian and where and when it is Wigner-Dyson. And as the system size increases, the curves get steeper and steeper. And this crossing point, if you allow me to conjecture that the finite size effects here are small. Well, it's now a random graph. So, yeah, random. Right. So I have to, I'll come to that, just a second. So that actually, this transition is very good. I forgot to switch it off and now, sorry. Yes, sorry, it's very, I forgot about it. So I would like to argue that in the case where we have some analytical treatment of this problem, the transition that we see in this way, which is indicated by these bars, is very well coincides with what we expect analytically. So we believe that there is some truth in it. Now, what happens in this so that was in the case. Sorry, I forgot to say something very important. That this agreement happens for the model in which we have analytical solution on the random graph, and that happens only when we have a simple local, purely local charge interaction. Then we have agreement, and that makes us to believe that this is that this level of statistics gives us more or less correct result. So now we can ask what level statistics give when we have, just a second, what happened here? Okay, yes, so when we have non-local Coulomb interaction between the sites. And here we see that this transition point shifted dramatically with respect to what we had before without Coulomb interaction. But then there is a problem that Vadim mentioned, that all this level statistics works pretty well if and only if we have many states. But we are interested in low energy transition, low temperatures, and therefore we have to make sure that at low energies, when we have our statistics is poor, our transition doesn't shift significantly. And for that, we have looked also to avoid this to make sure that we are not fooling ourselves, we also looked at the participation ratio for this localization problem. And what we saw is that we can choose the quantity, which is participation ratio for these graphs, has typically two peaks. And we can plot the probability of this participation ratio to be small or large. And then we see on this curve the transition, which also coincides with what we see at the with level statistics. But this participation ratio, we now can study much better at low energies. And we see that the transition at low energies indeed shifted somewhat with respect to high energies, but not so very significantly. Now, of course, that is all about the transition between insulator between the coherent and incoherent phases. Now it's much easier job to find the transition, numerically the transition between the superconductor and the normal phase, because we just have to study susceptibility, do similar analysis, and find it, and then compare to these two results. And lo and behold, what we see is that the transitions which we see from the level statistics and the transitions that we see from the ordered phase become separated once and only once the long-range interaction is switched on. So that is exactly this evidence for the appearance of some strange incoherent phase, even at low energies, low temperatures, that I wanted to tell you about. In the presence, and I emphasize again, only in the presence of Coulomb interaction. So we can also see, and that is a sanity check, that as the capacitance with ratio of capacitance of the junctions to the ground capacitance goes to zero, this region shrinks. So, and we recover back something that one expects. One expects theoretically. One expects. Okay, so now, as I said, I'm going to mumble a few words about possible reason for this non-trivial behavior. And the possible reason, it provides any explanation, just putting, as I think Boris said some years ago, when you do not understand something, you blame it on glass. So here I want to do exactly that. And I want to say that the reason why the long-range interaction leads to this very weird result is the formation of classical glass. So let's forget about the Josephson energy. Just look at the classical insulating state with these offset charges and long-range interaction, and ask ourselves if we see what are the properties of this state. And what you observe is that, as one would expect, the formation of a pseudo gap that is nothing but a Frosch-Kloski phenomena, but on the top of it, extremely slow relaxation of magnetization in all dimensions larger than one. I do not have time to explain, but even though the inverse Laplace in one dimension is linear in distance, so there is an extremely long range interaction in one dimension between the classical variables, still there is no glass formed. Yes. Magnetization, it's in the language of these pseudo spins. In two dimensions. So what you see is, that there is a very slow relaxation of magnetization, which is different from what one sees in the Schoenkin-Patrick model, where we understand it. So there is no aging, but there is no usual scaling, but there is something. So to summarize, because I have to finish in 1 minute, I have shown you experimental data that indicate the formation of this very weird bad metal state in a purely bosonic system. There is nothing like fermion excitations. And I have shown you that there is some indication for the same bad metal, or rather incoherent insulator, if you wish, call it as you want, in the numerical solutions. And the problem that we face is how to understand theoretically what happens in this. Let me bring it back so that it stays here, in this model with random offset charges and Josephson coupling, in the case where the C is long range, where the inverse capacitance is a long range interaction. So, thank you.
Questions, please? Yes.
You mentioned that the superconductor insulator transition in thin films. As one of the slides, you mentioned that. So yeah. Is there any, I mean, what is the evidence that those films show similar behavior as Josephson junction arrays in your opinion?
What is the evidence? And then I didn't hear.
That the thin films, they are showing behavior which is similar to the Josephson junction arrays, because that's still debated, I thought.
Well, I do not want to discuss whether they are. What we know is that in these films, that at least the ones that I have shown you, there is no formation of there is no closing of superconducting gap. So you can argue that the only, if you know that the electrons remain paired, and that you know from STM, the only variables that you have in your system are the phase and of course conjugate charge. So what else can you?
I mean, the fact that there is no fermionic degree of freedom
is experimental fact.
So you think in the superconductor insulator? I just want to know.
No, it's just experimental fact that was measured by a few groups, that STM shows very good gap in these materials, in the ones that I have shown. For which data I have shown. Now there is a different class of materials in which there is the gap is closed, gap closes, and the transition has a completely different nature. So both are possible, but there are materials in which the gap stays intact. In fact, it even grows when you make them more disordered. Well, at least stays the same. And so the only logical possibility is that you have phase and charge. In this case. Yes.
A couple of questions. So how should I think about your random graph? Is it like percolating cluster of some strongest?
Well, you see, if you do try to do at least this type of simulations on the regular lattice, you always are dominated by boundaries. So the idea of this of all this work was to find the system where you can to simulate the systems where you are not dominated by boundaries. So on this random graph, each side is connected to exactly three neighbors. It's k equal to random graph. And then you just increase the size of the graph, and of course you just generate these random graphs randomly, and you throw away also all the ones that were not born properly. That is the ones which have dangling bones or something like that. So you generate all possible configurations with k, which is z equals 3 number of neighbors and a given number of sides.
Okay, that's your theoretical model, but physically, how should I think about it?
There is no, you should not think about it.
So, okay, but that's, it kind of
no, you,
connects.
When we, in this experimental work that I told you about, we checked that regardless of the number of neighbors, the result is the same. And moreover, we can experimentally, we can generate something very similar to these random graphs because our basic element is not this little rounded island. It's like a wire. And the wire can have as many connections as you want. So you have wires in different planes, and the Josephson junction is of this sort. So we can always make absolutely any topology that you want. we are not limited to the connection to nearest neighbors in this way.
Okay.
I can show you later.
Okay, but sort of a question related to this and the previous one, but then you sort of, okay, you choose some Josephson junctions that give you your random graph, but the other ones can provide a reservoir. So maybe we don't have Peyronie quasi-particles, but we can think effectively of a reservoir. After all, it's a metal. So some has a finite...
Wait a second. It's not a metal, it's a superconductor, right?
But it has finite conductance. Right? So that was your whole point. You've got conductivity.
At the temperatures at which all the experiments are done, the number of quasi-particles in each wire is zero.
But the conductance is finite. So that's what you were trying to explain, the metallic phase.
Right, but the conductance happens only through the Josephson junction. So conductance, if you think about it as dissipation process, is due to creation of boson quasi-particles, not because of the ferments from which it is built.
On your cluster, but I'm saying there are other Josephson junctions which you disregarded, and then they can act as a reservoir.
Yes, so it's exactly the question whether it is possible that due to the collective effects, the rest of the system, in which everywhere you have a gap, works as a reservoir for your small part.
Maybe it's an offshoot of Eugene's question, but so either from the theory or numerics or prior experiments, can you suggest ideas for making this intermediate metal phase bigger?
No. It was a surprise to me that we found it in these numerical simulations at all.
Can you induce charge noise? If you say charge noise is important.
Well, what we can do, well, you see, the problem is that, No, there is one experimental, that there is some experimental evidence that was never confirmed again. And this, which is due to Panettiere group in Grenoble. And for historical reasons, Panettiere retired. His postdoc, his student, decided to quit physics. The work was never continued. But they have seen extremely wide range for this strange behavior in a two-dimensional arrays of very special geometry, of T3 geometry, you know, this lattice. T3 is dual to Kagome. So whether it is true or not, I do not know, but that was their claim. So if you believe that, then it will think that sort of very frustrated two-dimensional lattices help you to create this strange intermediate phase.
If the intermediate phase is the classical glassy phase, should one be able to see all sorts of hysteretic effects, effects? Is it seen experimentally?
My at least intuitive feeling about it that intermediate phase is the classical glass which were given some dynamics by quantum fluctuations. So without quantum fluctuations, this will be simply stuck, right? Because it's a glass phase. But because it's a glass phase, it means that there are some very soft directions in the phase space, you know, Weigl. And so when you include quantum fluctuations, the system starts to flow in these very soft directions. At least that's the picture of the usual Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model. So, but without this flow, there is nothing.
But basically, experimentally, there is no evidence of hysteretic effects, simply just on the experimental side.
No, there is not and there cannot be, because the experiment is done at the time scales, well, the experiment that I cite, well, any experiment that I know exists, was done on the time scales of seconds. And the time scale of seconds is far more than you expect. Well, the intrinsic dynamics is at the scale of gigahertz, and the system is not so large. So, and as I said, even the potential, which is formed by these charges, changes probably at the time of milliseconds. So how could you expect any hysteresis in this case, when even the random fields are changing so quickly? The experiment that might show this hysteresis will be microwave experiment, but that is Well, that's only that's promised to be done, but not yet.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank speaker again.